You're in the grand theme of things. The Logbook.com soundtrack mixtape podcast is back with more selections, all centered around a single theme, a setting, similar plots, maybe something else, all from the realm of the fantastic and the futuristic. Something connects all the music you'll be hearing today. I'm Earl Green. Sit back and relax and enjoy a little bit of free association with music from movies, TV, and games. It's all in the grand theme of things. Welcome to yet another special edition of In the Grand Theme of Things. We're slipping in another extra this month. We did it in July for the arrival of the Juno mission at Jupiter, and we are equally spaced out this time for this special edition, which concerns the music of Star Trek. Because guess what? Today's the 8th of September. It's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. However, I'm going to do something a little bit, perhaps a little bit subversive, in that we are not going to actually listen to music from the Star Trek TV shows today. This special edition of In the Grand Theme of Things concerns music from Star Trek fan films. Fan films, of course, are fan-made stories made with varying degrees of skill and ingenuity in various portions of the Star Trek timeline. And I'm sure I really don't have to explain much more than that, because there's a wide spectrum of them. Some of them are shot entirely against blue screen. Some of them are shot in what really looks like the corridors in, you know, the outside the waiting room in a doctor's office. Some of them are shot on startlingly nice sets constructed to look exactly like the original Enterprise from the 1960s. And I've actually visited one of those sets, and I highly recommend it to anyone who has the time and the opportunity to go tour such a place. Because, unfortunately, as I record this, Paramount and CBS have finally released some fan film guidelines that reduce most of the actual sets that have been built to basically tour attractions. Stuff can still be filmed there, of course, but in many respects, CBS and Paramount have clamped down on things that will force future fan filmmakers to use some serious ingenuity to keep telling a story within those restrictions. I have a fondness for Star Trek fan films in the same way that I have a fondness for, say, the Big Finish Doctor Who audios and the Virgin Publishing Doctor Who novels of the 1990s, because there are some very strong parallels between Doctor Who and Star Trek, not least of which is that both shows completely reshot their pilot episodes from the ground up, because the networks which were bankrolling each respective series saw the potential, but decided that the pilot that they were shown wouldn't cut it. Both shows have also gone through lengthy wilderness years, where there hasn't been anything to speak of, nothing produced. We are coming to the end of such a wilderness period for Star Trek, and it is not the first wilderness period that Star Trek has endured. The first one, arguably, would be between the 1969 cancellation of the original series and the 1979 premiere of Star Trek The Motion Picture. Yeah, a very long drought, which was punctuated only by Filmation's Star Trek animated series in the early 70s, which lasted for two very short seasons. And while I have a great deal of fondness for the animated Star Trek, there are quite a few people who could care less. It, you know, it's live action or nothing. Doctor Who, on the other hand, had the advantage of having been chronicled in audio from the very beginning, even as a television show. It was not uncommon for fans to trade tapes of episodes in audio form, simply because the VHS and beta revolution hadn't taken hold yet, and various fans had been recording Doctor Who episodes in audio from the very beginning, which is incidentally the only way that we actually have audio chronicles of every Doctor Who episode that has ever been made, whereas many of those episodes no longer exist in film or video form. Star Trek fandom's response to the wilderness years in the 1970s was to embark on fanfic of wildly varying quality and subject matter. He said with a smirk. There's fanfic for everybody. I'm just gonna leave it there. That's all I'm gonna say. But also, Star Trek fandom started to embark on technical documentation of that universe, with such things as the Starfleet star charts, which were put together by Jeffrey Mandel, with the help of an enthusiastic young fan named Doug Drexler. And it's kind of funny, both of them went on to work on Star Trek professionally. Doug Drexler, of course, went on to do makeup with Michael Westmore on Star Trek The Next Generation, and I believe early Deep Space Nine. But at that point, he decided he wanted to transfer into the computer graphics department on Deep Space Nine under Michael Okuda. And the funny thing is that it was very easy from there to jump over to actually producing CGI, which Drexler did on some of the later Star Trek spinoffs, such as Enterprise. Drexler went on to work on Battlestar Galactica and Caprica, among others, and then came full circle, providing visual effects shots for Star Trek Continues, which is probably the best-known fan-made series at this point in the Star Trek universe. Now, it's kind of interesting that Star Trek Continues is really not represented in today's podcast. That's because it generally tends not to do its own music. Star Trek Continues is one of two very prominent series, the other one being Star Trek Phase 2, also known as Star Trek New Voyages, which has closed down shop. They have stopped making new material, and the general consensus kind of seems to be, in an unspoken way, it'll be a cold day in hell before we see the unfinished stuff that they did produce, as they had something like two or three episodes in the pipeline that were never completed, and it's starting to look like they may not be. Star Trek New Voyages has, of course, given way to the Star Trek set tour in Ticonderoga, New York, which is now officially licensed by CBS and Paramount as a perfect recreation of the 1960s Enterprise sets as they were laid out in Desilu Studios. James Cawley of New Voyages has been offering tours and has been holding, sort of smallish convention-type events on his sets for several years now, but now it's an officially licensed product. And it's all that remains, sadly, of New Voyages, which is a show I was quite fond of. I kind of liked New Voyages sometimes even when its rough edges showed, sometimes because its rough edges showed. And we'll get into the reasons for that later. However, New Voyages is barely represented in this podcast. Star Trek Continues, not at all. And here is why. Because both of those productions aim to extend the short run of Star Trek on television beyond the 3 years that Kirk-era Trek got on NBC. Both James Cawley and Vic Mignogna have cast themselves as Captain Kirk, and they have recast the roles of Mr. Spock, Dr. McCoy, and so on down the line, basically attempting to, each in its own way, create further seasons of the original Star Trek. One of the things that they do, and we'll get into this more a little bit later, one of the things they do to maintain that fidelity to the original Star Trek is that they use the time-honored practice of reusing the same library of music that original Star Trek used to the point that we all had it memorized from daily reruns in the afternoons by the time we were teenagers. That's not to say that these productions all do that. And Phase 2, or New Voyages, whichever you want to call it, it is neither of those things now. So take your pick. New Voyages has attempted on a few occasions to be a little bit more original than that. And also, there is a kind of elephant in the room of Star Trek fan film music, which we'll get around to discussing, that did not exist for much of the early run of Phase 2, which limited the music library they had access to. So here is a case where Phase 2 actually had a composer do original music for them in more of a cinematic vein. The composer in question is Alan Dirian, and he composed the soundtrack to the episode World Enough and Time, which was co-written by Mark Scott Zickrey, and basically featured Sulu being caught in a time warp where, even though the rest of the Enterprise crew is being played by much younger actors, they brought George Takei in to play aged Sulu, because George Takei is less fated aged Sulu now. Actually, he's cooler than Sulu ever was now. Alan Dirian has done animation soundtracks for such productions as Veritas and Prince of Truth, short films like Cryptid, Duality, Civil War Diary, and Ray Bradbury's Kaleidoscope. He was an orchestrator, which means that he helped to devise the arrangements for the 2003 animated film Batman: Mystery of the Batwoman. He didn't actually do the music, but he came up with the arrangement from the melody score that was arrived at by the composer on that production. And Alan Dirian, I'm happy to say, he's grown up to be a real composer. He is the house composer for the CBS TV series Madam Secretary, which stars Taya Leone. And this is more or less where it all started for him. Here are a few short excerpts from Alan Dirian's score from World Enough and Time, Star Trek Phase 2 episode from 2000, I believe it was 2008. We'll be right back. Music from the Star Trek Phase 2 or Star Trek New Voyages episode World Enough in Time, or in Friends parlance, the one with George Takei. Music was by Alan Durian, and it was one of the last instances of one of the, shall we call it, Neo-Kirk Star Trek fan films trying to do original music. So let's get back to that elephant in the room. In 2012, La La Land Records made a lot of people very happy and probably paid their bills for about the next 5 years by releasing a 15-CD box set of basically every note of music recorded for the original Star Trek, everything from the cage up to the third season. Now, there seems to be a misconception that Star Trek had original music in the first season and just tracked everything from that for the rest of the show, and that couldn't be further from the truth. Star Trek had original music as late as the episode The Empath in the third season. Now, it was common practice for the Desilu music editors to slice and dice bits of music that had been composed originally for the first and second seasons. But the thing is, between seasons, Alexander Courage would come in with a new orchestra and re-record all of these little slice-and-dice pieces of previous episode scores. That was per musicians' union rules. So what you were hearing were actually new performances of the same music, but they were not just the same tapes that had been used already. The La La Land Records box set is a wondrous and magical thing. If you, like me, grew up with Star Trek, it's just one of the best soundtrack purchases you've ever made. And, yeah, I know I can certainly attest to that on my end. The booklets that come with it, the liner notes, are fantastic and tell you more than you ever knew, possibly more than you ever wanted to know about the music of the original Star Trek. However, that box set making every note of music that had ever been made for classic Star Trek available to everyone, that quickly became a game killer for some fan films because it was like, hey, we can do what the original Star Trek did and cut up this music ad nauseum the way they did it. We don't have to come up with any more new music. What happens to your Alan Durians of the world when you do that? You're kind of undercutting a whole corner of creativity that could make your production truly original by saying that you're just going to draw from the same well that classic Trek has been drawing from for, you know, let's just call it what it is, 50 years. So from here on out, most of our fan film music is not from either of the productions that wanted to extend the life of the original Star Trek. These are from completely original stories that just happened to take place in the Star Trek universe. This next one was very heavily promoted in 2015. It was the all-star celebrity production Star Trek Renegades, directed by Tim Russ, featuring Tim Russ reprising his role as Tuvok, and Walter Koenig reprising the role of Chekhov. And it puts both of these characters, you know, in their very realistically aged state, way past the end of the Voyager timeline, at which point Tuvok would have come home to the Federation, and gives them a new threat. Renegades is a fantastic little piece of fan filmmaking. It's a little silly, it's a little bit overacted in places, a little bit overbaked, but it's enjoyable. I don't think I can really seriously accept it as a new entry in the canon, the sacred canon, but, you know, it's certainly not without its charms. And just as the cast was filled with celebrities and big names, including people who had never had any prior connection to Star Trek, such as Lexa Singh, was played by Adrienne Wilkins, who played Xena's daughter Eve in the final season of Xena Warrior Princess. Other big names featured in Star Trek Renegades include Corin Nemec, who briefly replaced... I forget the guy's name now because it's not James Spader. Replaced him for one season on Stargate SG-1. It's going to come back to me as soon as I hit the stop button. I just know it. Trust me on this. He was on Stargate SG-1 for one season. There are also some fairly big names behind the scenes. Tim Russ directed. The story was co-written by writers who had had prior connections to such Star Trek productions as Deep Space Nine and Voyager. And if you listen to the music closely, you might notice something sounds a little bit familiar, and it's not because they tracked it from a CD of something else. Justin R. Durbin collaborated with Tim Russ, Sky Conway, and company on their prior all-star celebrity Star Trek fan film of Gods and Men. He was back for Renegades. However, his friend and mentor Dennis McCarthy helped him compose the theme. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it really should. Dennis McCarthy's tenure on Star Trek outstrips every other composer who's ever had anything to do with the franchise. He scored the first episode, the pilot episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. He scored the last episode of Star Trek Enterprise. I really think they need to shoehorn him in somehow to Star Trek Discovery. Have him do the theme. Have him do one episode. Just for kicks. Why not? I actually like Dennis's music. It's not the audio wallpaper that so many people like to put it down as. The scores to both Of Gods and Men and Renegades are commercially available. That's how I come to have this music from Star Trek Renegades by Justin R. Durbin with an assist from Dennis McCarthy.
Thank you.
Music from Star Trek Renegades by Justin R. Durbin. Theme composed with Dennis McCarthy of Star Trek The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise fame. Dennis has composed more hours of Star Trek music than anyone else can claim to. Justin Durbin has also composed music for other fan films, such as the Star Wars fan film Threads of Destiny, as well as episodes of Dark Armada, which is a Star Trek fan film series made in the Netherlands. He also composed the score for the Lifetime movie, Perfect High. So, Justin Durbin, yet another Star Trek fan film composer who has gone on to do some real TV. Our next two selections are a 1-2 punch from one composer who goes by the stage name of Heterain. He's a Canadian composer. He is also a podcaster. He hosts a podcast of his own on the Vienna Symphonic Sample Library, which is a spectacularly expensive orchestral sample library for people who have Cubase or other sorts of Nuendo VST programs that can use sample libraries. Vienna Symphonic is incredible. It sounds incredible. I couldn't afford it if I sold my house right now. Seriously. Hetterain has also scored episodes of Dark Armada. There's that that Dutch-made Star Trek fan film again. As well as episodes of other Star Trek fan films, including Hidden Frontier and Star Trek Osiris. I cannot find any professional credits for him beyond this, so he is a bit of an exception to the rule here. Our previous composers, whose work has been featured on this podcast, have gone on to, you know, work on network television, or at least cable. Hetterain seems to be happy working within the sphere of Star Trek fandom. The first selection, and I don't normally cop to this on in the grand theme of things, but I'm just going to come out and say it. This first selection is possibly my favorite original music for a Star Trek fan film ever. It is from the sadly now defunct fan series Star Trek, or Starship Exeter. Sorry, CBS. Starship Exeter was produced in Austin, Texas by brothers Jim and Josh Johnson, who assumed stage names in the opening credits because they not only co-wrote the stories and directed and built the sets, they starred in it as well. But I think they were trying to make it look a little less like, you know, this is all these guys do. So they adopted stage names as far as their acting went. So it perhaps looked like there were more cooks in the kitchen than there actually were. Star Trek Exeter only produced two episodes. The first one was called The Savage Empire, and it dealt with Klingons. And Savage Empire kind of betrayed the fantastic work that the Johnson brothers did on their sets by shooting in, quite frankly, it looked like they shot it on a VHS camcorder. Or maybe high 8. I don't know what they shot on. The video quality was not great. However, there was a lot of endearing enthusiasm in Savage Empire. Their second episode was called The Tresorian Intersection, which brought on a completely original alien race to be the villains. And it's just, it is one of the best Star Trek fan films anyone has made. And it took a long time for us to see it. Star Trek Exeter released their episodes in little chunks. They basically aped the American commercial television format of fading out at a suspenseful moment. You know, go to black, fade to break. And they would release their episodes act by act. So you would have to wait possibly months for the complete story to be told. Now, in light of the fan film regulations that CBS has rolled out recently, one wonders if that is not perhaps the way forward. I mean, as aggravating as it was at the time, waiting for Exeter to complete a single story, everything now has to be 15 minutes or under. Well, most acts, you know, Act 1, Act 2, whatever, on commercial television, weigh in well under 15 minutes. Yeah, perhaps the Exeter boys, the Johnson brothers, may have been doing it right all along, and we may have to go back to that. However, Tresorian Intersection in particular had a very long and tortured curve of production history, because during the post-production of the Tresorian Intersection, the Johnson brothers basically decided, we're not doing this anymore. And it fell to the director, whose name was Scott Cummins, to finish the final act. And here's the thing. The gap between Act 4 and Act 5 being released, or it may actually be Act 3 and Act 4. I may have to go back and look at that. The last two acts, the next to last act of the story and the final act of the story that closes the episode out, there was something like a 2 or 3 year gap between those. And during that gap, Exeter just became something of an urban legend. It was just like, you know, we're never going to see this story finished. Which it was always the intention of the director to get it finished, and he finally enlisted the help of Neo Effects, which is a visual effects house that works on the Star Trek fan production Starship Farragut. And Farragut had already... It's kind of important to notice that in this gap between the penultimate and final act of the Tresorian Intersection being released, virtually the rest of Star Trek fan filmdom happened. That's how long it took. And so it was kind of a shock to actually see the thing finished. Most of the music from the earlier acts of the Tresorian Intersection was composed by Stephen Cadena, and the main theme had been established already in The Savage Empire. I love the main theme for Starship Exeter, because they style it deliberately to sound like this kind of the groovy 60s bongos of the classic Star Trek theme. But the way it's arranged, the way it sounds, it's just wonderful. I love it. I mean, you actually believe that you're turning on the TV in 1969 and Star Trek in some alternate universe is so popular it has gotten this spin-off with this fantastic theme tune. And this is a rarity. I actually cannot find a credit for who composed the theme music for Starship Exeter. But the reason I bring up the theme music at all is because Heterain drives this thing relentlessly through minor keys for this final act of the Tresorian Intersection in a way that just, you know, he just goes John Williams with it. Because John Williams will establish a leitmotif, and then he will drive that through every possible major and minor variation that he can in the course of a big action sequence. And the last act of the Tresorian Intersection is drenched with music from start to end, and that's really the vast majority of what you're about to hear here. So, let me stop talking and play you some bloody music here. Here's Heterain's music, as well as some by Stephen Cadena from the sorely missed Star Trek fan production, Starship Exeter. Music from the Starship Exeter, second and final episode, the Tresorian Intersection. Boy, that's a tongue twister. Boy. Music was by Stephen Cadena and, for the most part, by Heterane, including the show's existing main theme, which I actually had to pull off the end credits of the episode to feature in that suite there. But I love it so much, I couldn't not play it. And besides, I kind of needed to put that at the beginning as a point of reference, so you understand what it sounds like as a motif during the action sequence, which is just spectacular. Next slice of music is also by Heterane. It is from the fan series Starship Farragut. Heterane has actually released several of his Starship Farragut scores. Heterane has been scoring Starship Farragut since it began, including its main theme. You know, he's able to do something similar here that he did for the final episode of Exeter. So, having spent so much time talking about Heterane and what wonders he worked for Starship Exeter, let's jump straight into his music for Starship Farragut, which includes some very interesting samples. I think he was trying very hard, as so many of us have tried, to figure out something that can evoke the sound of the blaster beam from Star Trek The Motion Picture. Here's Heterane's music from Starship Farragut. We'll be right back. Starship Farragut music by Hetering, who has kind of dominated this podcast, hasn't he? He has made music from most of his fan film productions available on CD at cdbaby.com. I will include a link so you can go and pick up some of his stuff and hear it at a decent sound resolution. Really, don't just take my word for it. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. I'm going to be bold enough to say that, considering that some of the final season of Enterprise was scored entirely with synthesizers, yeah, I can totally put music from Star Trek fan films on the same shelf as the latter years of the franchise as televised. Finally, our final selection here is from Starship Intrepid, sometimes also referred to as Star Trek Intrepid. I think they all have to strip the name Star Trek out of the titles now. I have no idea what Star Trek Continues is going to do under these new strictures. You know, it's going to be the Kirk and Spock buddy cop show. Hey, kids! Starship Intrepid is produced in Scotland. And yes, this means you have a 24th century Intrepid-class ship, basically the same kind of ship as Voyager, staffed entirely by Scottish people. You probably think I'm laughing at this, and it does sound funny on the surface, but here's the thing. I love Scottish accents. I can sit and watch these people do Star Trek all stinking day long. And I really kind of wish they'd get back to it, but Nick Cook and the rest of the gang over there, of course, are as subject to the whims of real life as me and everyone else in the world. The main theme for Starship Intrepid is by Dylan Feeney. The incidental music score is by David Bukes. I think that's how you pronounce it. David, my apologies if I just mispronounced your name on the off chance you're listening to this. David Bukes has no further IMDb credits beyond Starship Intrepid or other fan productions. He co-composed a song for the YouTube series Epic Hip Hop called Emotions Chasing Mass Love. So he has been doing other things. It just hasn't been in the realm of TV, and that's okay. And, you know, that may also apply to Hetering, who also seems to have no further IMDb credits beyond Star Trek fan films. I have absolutely no illusion that the guy is sitting around in a studio going, oh man, I wish Paramount would call me since they're doing this new show. No, you gotta put dinner on the table. I'm sure he's doing something. Here's music by David Bukes with main theme by Dylan Feeney from the Scottish Star Trek fan film production Starship Intrepid. Music from Starship Intrepid, a completely Scottish, a very Scottish fan film series. Music is by David Bukes. The main theme was by Dylan Feeney. Hopefully Nick and the gang kind of get back to it. By the way, that music, I would be, for those of you looking for details, that music was from the episode Heavy Lies the Crown, which was, I believe, that may have been the first episode they did. The soundtrack was made available as a free download by the composer. So that's it. Happy 50th birthday, Star Trek. Here is why I just celebrated your 50th birthday with a bunch of fan film music. Because if it weren't for the efforts of the fans, and I believe this is also true for Doctor Who, we wouldn't be celebrating the imminent arrival of new Star Trek on our TVs or our computers, as it's going to be a video-on-demand internet series, except actually sanctioned by CBS this time. I'm talking there, of course, about Star Trek Discovery. I don't think we would be getting Star Trek Discovery if the fans hadn't demonstrated over these past 10 years since Star Trek Enterprise left our screens that there was a very hungry marketplace for these productions. There are several other fan films that have included original music, such as Prelude to Axanar, which is the only mention that I'm going to make of that particular production in this podcast. And there have been a few others. Several other fan film productions have sliced and diced existing soundtracks. I know Hidden Frontier, they delightfully took the main theme from Galaxy Quest, composed by David Newman. The theme from the TV show within the movie that they kept showing reruns of. They took the Galaxy Quest theme and used it in deadly earnest, as well as the soundtrack from the movie, because, quite frankly, the entire Galaxy Quest soundtrack is the best Star Trek soundtrack that has never graced a Star Trek movie. I've got to play some Galaxy Quest sometime, except that's one of those things where it's like the soundtrack to WALL-E, where, you know, if I get started, I'm going to wind up with 30 minutes, and I'm going to play half the bloody album, and at that point, I might as well just, you know, point you to a torrent or something, which that would be bad. You should actually be supporting the labels and the artists who do this stuff. But, yeah, Galaxy Quest, I'm not sure I can ever play on this podcast because I would start putting it together and I wouldn't know when the hell to stop. So there you have it, a history of Star Trek fan productions in music. Probably more music than you gave it credit for. I really liked it when they were doing original music with their productions. You know, the various producers of these things. Because at the time that most of this stuff was made, which I would say, you know, your hot spot for fan filmmaking was probably between 2007 and really the past couple of years. But the past few years have been dominated by using that 15 CD box set of classic Star Trek music. Which, if you're doing something set in the 24th century like Intrepid was doing, that's not going to work. Because that was not the sound of 90s Star Trek. The reason I kind of come down hard on the fan film producers for leaning so heavily on that box set, as lovely and as authentic as it is, and as wonderfully remastered as it is, which does so much of the work for them, Here's the thing. You have such a hard time arguing that your product is something original and not a complete ripoff when you are already borrowing so much. You're borrowing a look and a feel. You're borrowing a setting. You're borrowing the universe. And then you go in and borrow the music that goes with that universe. That's kind of one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast, to do a Star Trek podcast around fan film music. Because the truth of the matter is, I really have a lot more artistic respect for the guys who have been doing their own thing. Now, don't get me wrong, I liked Phase 2, I liked Star Trek Continues, but as fun as it is to watch them try, neither James nor Vic is William Shatner. I have a lot more respect for the guys from Farragut, the guys from Exeter, the guys from Intrepid, who are telling their own story. They're not trying to say, hey, I'm Captain Kirk, I'm Mr. Spock, I'm Data. You know they're not. You know they're not. And while we're getting to a point where Star Trek has been around long enough, I mean, 50 years, it's kind of like reinterpreting Shakespeare. You know, Sir Laurence Olivier is not the only actor who has ever done Shakespeare. And neither is Patrick Stewart, incidentally. There are a million and one ways to do Shakespeare. You can modernize it, and suddenly you have West Side Story. I'm not saying that Star Trek is in any danger of going into the public domain. You have endless revisions of copyright law that try to trend toward infinity to thank for that. But fan films are sort of like the community theater of the internet. You're taking the classics and reinterpreting them. And it's even better if you kind of have to make your own thing. So I will include links to several of these productions for your amusement and perusal. And just know that I and a lot of other people really enjoy these things for what they are. We know they're not Hollywood. We know that they are Austin, Texas. We know that they're Oklahoma City. We know that they're Georgia. We know that they're Ticonderoga, New York. We know that they're Scotland. Boy, it's hard to miss that. It's hard to miss it when it's Scotland. But the point is, knowing that, you also know that these are other fans just like you, and they are living the dream. And it's fun to watch them do that. The ones who are capable of doing it. It just puts a smile on my face. And yeah, you could almost be forgiven for thinking that Star Trek hasn't been off the air at all. Pretty soon it'll be back on, and we'll talk about that some more next time. Thanks for listening to In the Grand Theme of Things. We will return with a proper Star Trek music podcast later, I promise. That's all for now. In the Grand Theme of Things, we'll return to the realms of the imagination with more movie, TV, and game music, all connected by a common theme. Just a reminder, all of the music you've heard is copyrighted by the respective composers, labels, and studios. Visit www.thelogbook.com/grandtheme for a listing of what you heard in this installment and links to purchase your own copies. Due to restrictions on file size and storage, what you've heard today was presented at a fairly low audio quality. By purchasing the commercially available CDs or downloads, you can hear it even better. I strongly encourage you to support the labels that are taking the time and expense to remaster and reissue classic soundtrack music. They're making music available to which longtime movie and TV music fans have never dreamed of having access, and I hope you'll join me in supporting them. If you'd like to support In the Grand Theme of Things and other podcasts from thelogbook.com, such as Select Game and thelogbook.com's Escape Pod Daily Mini Podcast, drop by at www.thelogbook.com/grandtheme and click on the How You Can Help link. In the Grand Theme of Things is written, produced, and hosted by Earl Green.